This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Neil Reynolds Podcast. I am your host, of course, Neil Reynolds. Hope you're enjoying the series so far. We're up to episode 18. If you like what you're listening to, tell your friends. Tell everyone you know in the NFL, leave us a nice review if you can on iTunes. Give us a rating. That all helps as we spread the word. This week's episode, I'm back speaking with a media personality, and it's a good friend I met. We toured and went around the UK for the NFL UK Live stage shows, and we were together with Josh Norman, Emmanuel Sanders. My guest this week is Mr. Red Zone, Scott Hansen, who is an absolute joy to be with and work with. He's a bundle of energy. He is so excited all the time. You'll hear some of the stuff we talk about where he gets excited in TV studios. He sees the positive in everything. We were stuck. I remember we traveled from Scotland down to Manchester by train in a blizzard, and it took, must have been 8 or 9 hours. It took forever. We only just made the show, the next night's show. And Scott, everywhere we stopped, we had to get off trains and wait and get replacement buses and wait for the snow to stop. And everywhere we went, Scott was just like, this is brilliant. Look at the view. This is sensational. I'm loving it. He saw the positive in everything. And I think he's so positive on Sunday nights on Red Zone. And between Scott and myself, we kind of have the NFL locked down on your UK screens because of Sky's and Red Zone's coverage.
We do. I would say from... Well, we in the States, we say from sea to shining sea, but we could say over the other side of another sea there. We've got the entire English-speaking world covered, I think, when it comes to American football. And it's fun. Best job in the world, right, Neil?
It is, yeah. We're going to dig into that because there are so many aspects where it's similar. You're on 7 hours live every Sunday night. I do 8 hours live. There's lots of prep, lots of things that could potentially go wrong. It's really a fun job. It doesn't feel like a job. We're going to dig into lots of that. And our two worlds collided, of course, during the 2017 season playoffs. We will talk about that as well. But let's start with growing up. How big was football for you growing up?
Oh, that's a great question. Football came on my radar, I mean, as far back as I can remember. My father, who actually passed away this year he passed away from cancer, but it was during our coronavirus quarantine that my dad passed away. My dad was a huge football fan and gave me my love of football. He was captain of his high school football team when he was a kid. And I grew up around it and watching games and like looking at my dad to see how he would react, and ended up liking the same teams that he liked. A similar story to a lot of football families around the world. And then when I got to make my own choice, if I was going to play, if I was going to watch it, be around it, I just loved it. I just loved it so much. I loved everything about it. I loved the team concept. I loved the contact of football. Even when I was a little kid, I wasn't afraid of like bashing into somebody. In fact, so my parents had me play flag football growing up because they didn't want me to have contact until I was a little bit older. I was not allowed to play contact football until I was 13 years old. So as like a 10-year-old, I played flag football, and there are old photos of me, I mean, getting like going like up top on some kid. Oh, we got mouth guards in. That's all we have. And then there's another photo of me after having brought a kid to the ground. I don't remember this moment, but it was flag football. This kid's laying on the ground in front of me, and I'm like kneeling around like this, kneeling over the top of him. And the other kids like on my team are like, what did you just do? Like, maybe I'll send you the photo.
You were giving him the Chuck Bednarik over Frank Gifford.
You know what? It's almost kind of similar to that. And the other kids have this look on their face like, what is going on? But I loved everything about football. And my dream growing up since the time I was 8, 10 years old was to be an NFL football player. Well, the good Lord decided not to make me, you know, 6'5", 250, running a 4'5", 40, and I could only go as far as college in my career. And so when I knew I wasn't going to be paid money to play in the NFL, My parents always encouraged me, find something you love and try and make a career out of it. And so I was like, well, I don't think I'm going to be able to play football, but those guys on TV, they sound like they're having a heck of a fun time calling the games, and they get paid money to go on an airplane and fly to a different city each week and be at the stadium and get the best seats at the 50-yard line to look down. I was like, as a little kid, I'm thinking, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. And literally my childhood dream evolved from being an NFL football player to being an NFL football broadcaster. And the fact that I do the job that I do now and have the role that I have at NFL Media is a thrill like I can hardly explain.
So you had the high school football and the college football. So the player dream was still alive for a while. For me, very early, from the age of 15, it was about the media. So I remember having a Betamax copy of the AFC Championship game, the Broncos and the Browns. Remember where Ernest Byner fumbles down inside?
Sure, the fumble, yeah.
I used to turn the volume down and commentate over that game over and over again. So same dream, just different ways, I guess.
I need you to send me a copy of that. I want a digital copy of that for my own personal files of you calling the game if you have a recording of it. Well, so yeah, so your dream was that. My dream, about mid-high school, probably about 16, 17 years old, that's when I knew, you know what, the NFL's not going to happen. But I was still a very good high school player. And then I went and walked on. Is all your audience familiar what a walk-on is in the United States? Yep. Yeah, I don't know if they have a similar term for it or whatnot. But I was a walk-on at Syracuse University, which is a major Division I high-level college football. We were top 25 in the country all 4 years that I played there. And I went and walked on there. But I knew I wasn't going to the NFL. So a lot of times when we would have things going on around my football team, whether it was practice or a game or after the game, looking back at the video, I used to broadcast it. I would literally, to like pass the time, I would literally, I'd be broadcasting a practice. We'd be in practice, in the middle of practice. Now, I wouldn't be doing it out loud where it would irritate the coaches or anything, but I'd be looking for like the storylines and like building the drama of, oh yeah, Chris Gedney, one of my teammates, coming back from that twisted ankle that knocked him out of the West Virginia game. Will he be able to play against Pittsburgh this week? Oh, we'll find out. I used to make these things in my head, and it helped sharpen my skills for what I do now. That and the fact that I have the utmost respect for NFL players who are on another planet when it comes to physicality. And I was seeing, you know, guys at the major Division I college football level. I probably had, in my 4 years at Syracuse, I probably played on teams, those four teams, with 20 guys, maybe 15 to 20 guys that went on to the NFL, and only one or two of them that went on to like stardom in the NFL. So I realized the unbelievable physical prowess that they have. And that helps me, I believe, today to project the level of respect and to try and give the context of what we are seeing in terms of the height, weight, speed, impact that these guys have on a football field on an NFL Sunday for 3 hours.
So as Scott explains there, he's much more than just the sharp suit he wears on an NFL Sunday. But for most NFL fans, it's as a broadcaster that we know him. There isn't any tape we can go over to get a view of Scott Hansen, the college football player. So with his broadcast skills refined since his younger years, I needed to ask him to give me the rundown on Scott Hansen, the player.
Woo, okay. Look, the easiest evaluation is this. Good high school player. I was captain of my team, all conference. You know, I started for all my upper class years. Good high school player, scrub college player, especially at the Division I level. So for those who don't know, well, the way it was when I was growing up, we had Division I, Division II, and Division III. One being the highest level of college football, three being the lowest. If I would have gone and played like where I had offers to go and play at college, I would have been a Division III level player. And maybe I would have been a decent Division III player. Division I, again, I walked on. They didn't pay me any money to no scholarship to go to Syracuse University. But two things about that. One, I wanted to challenge myself at the highest level of football. And two, Syracuse University has the reputation here in the United States as being the best sports broadcasting school in the country. It was known to put out some of the top sportscasters in the history of the United States have gone on to, it's like the Oxford or the Harvard of sportscasting. And so I identified that early. I grew up in Michigan, but I went to school in New York because I was like, I'll go anywhere to get the best education that I can to help make me into a good sports broadcaster. So those were the reasons. But my college experience was fantastic. Being in the midst of being in the inside in the internal workings of a big time football team, I draw on experiences all the time in my NFL broadcasting career from my collegiate playing career, whether that means, you know, difficulties or challenges that a team is having or the success and the glory of the overcoming and the underdog winning a championship or just what 100 people in college, 100 guys, that's what we had when I played, or the 50 guys that play on an NFL team, what they're really trying to accomplish and the odds that are against them. And hopefully that translates as I broadcast on NFL Red Zone. And I will say this too. I learned about the value of winning. Everybody loves to win, but I learned what it takes to want to prepare to win. I played 4 years at Syracuse. We went to 4 bowl games, and there were fewer bowl games back then. Nowadays, almost everybody goes to a bowl, but back then there weren't as many bowl games. And we went 4-0 in those bowl games. Never lost the last game of the year. And that is such a thrill and such a, I take my teammates and I take great pride in that even to this day, 20 something years after we left college.
And what position did you play?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't say position. Yeah. Okay. This is interesting. So I walked on the team. Now in high school, I was an offensive lineman. Now I weighed 235 pounds, which you can put into whatever that is for kilograms. So 235, I was a bigger dude. I weigh about, like, as you look at me right now, I weigh about 180 right now. So I was 235. I was heavy, big in high school. And I played offensive line, center. Okay. When I walked down to Syracuse, the offensive linemen there were weighing 280, 290, 300 pounds. There was no way I could compete weighing what I weighed. But because I played center on my high school team, I also long snapped for punts and extra points and field goals. And I was pretty good at it. And so when I walked on, they gave me a 4-day tryout. They said, there's this kid from Michigan who wants to come and walk on the football team. We didn't recruit him. We never even have heard of him. You know, he gave us his credentials, you know, being all conference and captain of the team and blah, blah, blah. But we don't know anything about this guy. We don't know if we want him on the team. So I had 4 days in my true freshman year to prove myself. And, you know, contact, physicality and stuff, I was getting knocked around. But one day we did special teams, okay? And this was just the freshmen. The upperclassmen had not come in yet, just the freshmen. And they said, okay, whoever wants to hold for extra points, get in this line over here. Whoever wants to try and snap. And a few of us went over there, and I was like, I was keyed up. And I started snapping the football for extra points. We were lined up right there on the goal line. And I was throwing it through the hands of all the guys that wanted to be holders. And these guys were wide receivers and quarterbacks and running backs, the, you know, the skill position players. I was burning the football. They would, you know, hold it out. They said, hit, boom, and it was going through their hands. And the coach got so mad, he grabbed the last holder. He pulled my, he goes, I got to see this for myself. And the special teams coach got down on a knee and held out his hand, looked down at me from 7 yards away, said, hit. And I threw it through his hands. It burned through his hands. I mean, I was keyed up, my adrenaline flowing. And the coach stood up and he looked back at our head coach at the time, a guy named Dick McPherson, who went on to coach the New England Patriots for a short spell, but a legendary Hall of Fame collegiate coach. And the special teams coach stood up and looked at Coach Mack, who was watching from like up on high. He had this tower that he watched practice from so he could keep an eye on everything. And he goes, "Coach, Hansen came here to snap." And McPherson was looking down at him like he saw me burning it through the hands of all these guys. He's like, "All right, you know what?" And it was that moment that they decided to keep me around for that year. And then I ended up being on the team for 4 years, and the rest was history. Now, you say, okay, well, you were a long snapper, which I was, but you can't just long snap all practice.
Right.
So to add value, I played on the scout team, right? Do you guys call it the scout team there? Call it the demo squad or the scout team or whatever, just to give a look to the starters. And I played everything on the scout team. I played wide receiver. I played defensive back. They would put me at linebacker. They would put me at center sometimes. They would put me at, I got the tar beat out of me. I am telling you, I used to pop aspirin before practice
just because
I knew how bad I would hurt at the end of practice. You guys seen the famous movie Rudy, right? Rudy is the most famous football walk-on of all time. I was Rudy without the famous sack at the end of senior season with the guys carrying me off the shoulders. I had all of the practice smashing experience as you could have, but none of the glory, and yet, well, you can still see me. I still get fired up telling stories from my college football days.
So for the uninitiated among you, Scott's impassioned recollection of his college football career shows he is all in. That's just his character. Scott's someone who cares immensely about the sport and the role he plays in helping us all enjoy it on Sunday nights. Sometimes, however, that energy needs a moment to be refueled and redefined. So after establishing himself in sports casting, Scott soon took a break to pursue a passion away from the media and away from football.
That was an incredible journey, a journey that still continues to this day. So everything in my life, Neil, was built as a young adult and then as an early adult. Everything in my life was geared towards becoming the best sports broadcaster in the world. I was tunnel vision possessed with that is where I'm going to get all of my fulfillment, my satisfaction, my self-esteem. Everything was going to be built into being the guy that everybody looked to and all of that. And while sportscasting is great, our careers are great. I learned early on, I was in my mid-20s, and through a whole series of circumstances, my life just it went downward. My life spiraled downward. Everything externally looked like the trajectory was going upward. And yet internally, I had a real emptiness, a real, you might even call it a darkness or whatnot. And I went through a spiritual transformation. I became a Christian during that time. And in developing my Christian faith and looking at what it means to follow Jesus, I said, you know what? Nothing else can be bigger than this. If this is real, If this is really real, and if I'm really going to follow it, and as I do with basically everything in my life, I think you should give your all to everything that you find worthy to push towards. So I'm like, I want to grow in this. I want to grow. I want to mature in my faith, and I want to help others at the same time. And while I was thinking through this process, my sportscasting career was not as big anymore. It wasn't the thing that I looked to for all of my peace and fulfillment and satisfaction. I looked to God for that then and now. And so I decided to leave sportscasting, which seemed crazy at the time. I told my boss, I said, hey, I've gone through this transformation and I want to grow in this and I want to help others at the same time. And my boss was a female, and she said, Scott, you know, I don't really understand. I don't really agree with you leaving your career because we love you here and we want you to keep doing what you do. But if you feel that's what's best, okay. And so a couple months after I had this spiritual epiphany, I decided to leave sportscasting, and I went and I worked with Mother Teresa's organization. Everybody knows Mother Teresa or remembers her. She had a group here in the United States. Of course, she's from Calcutta, India, was where she first came on the world stage. But she had a group actually here in Los Angeles, where I'm speaking to you from right now, helping the poor and the homeless and illegal immigrants and people that were young boys that were at risk to go into the gang scene here in LA. We had this program that we did just to love people and share our faith with them and help them in their lives. And I was doing that, working in a soup kitchen, working in the homeless shelter, working in, doing street ministry of going out and bringing people food and whatnot. I was growing in my faith as I did that, reading my Bible and praying and growing. And my life got centered in a whole different way because of that time. It was about 1 year that I was gone from sportscasting. And by the way, Neil, when I left, I didn't say, I'm going to take 1 year off and then come back. When I left, I was like, Lord, you take me where you want me to go. And if you want me to go back into sportscasting, I'll do that. And if you want me to go and, become a clergyman or whatever, or serve the homeless full time for the rest of my life, whatever it is that I can do to glorify you and to grow in my faith, I'll do it. After about 1 year, and this is a longer answer than what you probably bargained for, but after about 1 year, I really felt centered again. And I said, you know what? I believe God has given me some gifts that match very well with my sportscasting career. Mm-hmm. And as long as I have proper perspective on it, as long as I'm not looking towards my sportscasting career for everything in my life, I want to try and do it again. And I want to try and do it and benefit others and grow in myself and glorify God through that. And so after 1 year, I decided to get back in. I didn't know if anyone was going to hire me, because once you leave and your resume has a 1 year gap on it, and that gap is like, you're working with homeless people, you're working with poor people. That has nothing to do with sportscasting. But there was a station down in Tampa, Florida, that decided to hire me, and the rest is history. I got back in my career, and I've just kind of grown and advanced then, and now I get seen coast to coast. And there was a great irony that at a time in my life when I opened my hand and I said, here, I'm giving this over. And the guy who gave that over was a guy who a year earlier wanted to be the host of NFL Red Zone, even though there was no such thing, right? And now this whole circle has kind of come back around, and I do have this national and international platform and profile. Life is a crazy thing, I guess I would say.
We'll be back with more from Scott Hansen after this short break on the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back. As Tampa Bay Buccaneers head coach Bruce Arians just said then, this is the Neil Reynolds Podcast. Now, before the break, we heard from NFL Red Zone Scott Hansen and how his college career and subsequent time in the media hasn't always been conventional, and neither is his enthusiasm for what he does as the anchor on Red Zone. He's someone who simply loves what he does when football Sundays come around.
My analogy that I use is when a new day begins and that first ball is on the tee and we're ready to go, and you know the possibilities are infinite as to what we could possibly see. I look at it as like weather. Like you're on a gorgeous beach and the waves are starting to roll in. And some of the waves are big and some of the waves are small, and some of the waves move in different directions, or they have different behaviors. But it's time to go out on a surfboard, as you and me are bringing the enjoyment to the people on the beach watching it. It's time to get on a surfboard and go ride those waves. And some of them might crush you. Some of them might just be little bumps, and then some of them might be glorious, where you get on top of that wave and everyone that's watching it just looks and just marvels at the beauty of it. And yet you never know, you can never predict how or when it'll change or what it'll happen, but you know it will. And you and I both, we get romantic about it, don't we? Right? I mean, it's It's you only get 17 of them
right.
each year. And that's what I tell our staff on NFL Red Zone. Guys, I know it's 5 in the morning when the alarm clock goes off, 5 in the morning
yeah.
Pacific time for us here in California where we originate the show. But I know people are tired and whatnot. You only get 17 of these. And in the middle of June, in the middle of July, whenever, in the deep off season, you're going to be wishing for just one of these Sundays.
Right.
And when you get them for 5 months in a row like that, it's just something just to savor, just to savor.
And, you mentioned it there, comparing it to weather as well. Actually, those are my favorite moments because I'm quite a fan of the Weather Channel and I quite like a bit of weather. Huh. When weather rolls into football, like delays in Tampa or delays in Miami or snow in New York, oh my goodness. I mean, that's another story. I just get, when you combine weather and football, I'm happy.
Yeah. So just real quick on that. Often, especially in December here in the States, that's where we get, you know, all of our inclement weather and the snow games. When we get a snow game, I don't care if it's a team that's 2-10 versus a team that's 1-11.
If
it's a blizzard and it's coming down in, let's say, Buffalo or you know, wherever, we will show that game because people just love watching it because right. it turns every one of us into a little kid again. And for those who had, you know, experience in 2 feet of snow going out, it's just the best. It's just awesome, you know? And so, yeah, we love weather too. Lightning, not so much because that can shut down. That's the only thing that can really shut down football is lightning. But, yeah, rainstorms, windstorms, snowstorms, it's a thrill.
Yeah, give me a snow game any day. I'll take it. I love the fact that, I mean, what you do is commercial free. I know you get asked all the time about not taking bathroom breaks. One of my favorite moments hosting Sky Sports coverage was when we came together on that Sunday night in the 2017 season playoffs. And we did the first 15 minutes of the pregame show. And then I turned to camera and I said, and now we're going to take a break on Sky Sports. And quick as a flash, before we went to commercial, do you remember what you said?
I probably was being playful a little bit and saying, break, what are we taking a break for? Were we soft? Come on.
Exactly.
Keep rolling with something like that.
You said a break? What is a break?
you get breaks on your show, though?
We have, so we'll when you take an American commercial, we will fill about 2/3 to maybe 80% of those. And then we take the occasional break. But most times we're coming back in from the break and I'm showing a minute of Red Zone. Then we're doing studio analysis or chatting like we did in the studio when you were there.
So that's similar to what we did when I was with you in studio there in London.
Exactly the same as how it was with you during the playoffs, but we put a minute of that at the start will be Red Zone stuff with me kind of going over that. So, of course, we had the Minneapolis Miracle reaction in the studio together, which to me just summed up, well, we do watch it like fans, right? That's what we're supposed to do.
Sure. I mean, and by the way, I know people see that video of me waking up dogs across the UK in the middle of the night with my shrieking. But I wasn't on camera at that moment. Now, it ended up getting captured on camera.
Right.
But I would have been more professional had we been on the air live. I still would have been excited. But that was my raw, real, natural, organic reaction to what I deduced in my mind may have been the greatest finish in divisional playoffs history. And we experienced it and saw it together. And yeah. I mean, I still get excited about it.
Any other moments like that throughout your career covering the NFL? I mean, I personally think of, I'll just give you an example. I was on the sidelines for Sky Sports in Super Bowl 49. I'm right down on the goal line and Malcolm Butler jumps that route and intercepts Russell Wilson. And to me, it was something instantly I knew I had witnessed NFL history. Have there been moments like that where you just kind of, they'll always stay with you? I mean, the Minneapolis Miracle would be one of them, but do you have other ones?
You know what? And by the way, I'm jealous of you. I was in the stands for that moment. I mean, I still was there and I saw it live, but I was not on the sidelines. So you're one up on me on that one. And that'll always be one of the greatest defensive plays in Super Bowl history because it clinched the game. Mine was similar. It was another Super Bowl. If you remember the Steelers-Cardinals Super Bowl in Tampa, And Santonio Holmes with the catch in the corner of the end zone. Now, I was on the sideline for that. And here, now picture this. So I'm on the sidelines, and I'm watching the game in front of me, and Roethlisberger is throwing in this direction. I'm on the sidelines, but because I have a sideline pass, you know, we can roam basically anywhere we want. So I am closer to that than the Pittsburgh Steelers players and coaches on the bench, because I was down around the 20, maybe the 15-yard line, and I got to see the pass, and I you know, leaned in, and I saw, and I'm like, I think he got that live. And you remember there was a long instant replay review, which was legitimate because it was such a razor-thin margin of how he got his feet down. They needed to make sure that it was a touchdown. And during the replay, you know, they put a couple of replays on the big screen, but Santonio Holmes comes up, and he's walking towards the sideline. So I'm in between, you know, Mike Tomlin and the coaching staff and the players and Santonio Holmes and Hines Ward, who were over here. And he comes running up, and he's yelling, and he goes right past me. He goes, I got it. I know I got it. He goes, that's how you be great. That's how you be great. And I mean, he was yelling at, and there's old NFL Films video that shows him saying that. It was during a commercial break, I'm sure, for the television audience, but the hair on my arm started standing up because
you're not just watching, right?
And I knew this was a cataclysmic moment in Super Bowl history.
Yeah, you're not just watching it, you're feeling it, you're hearing it, you're there.
And especially with those two teams battling back and forth. If you remember the series before, Kurt Warner, Hall of Famer, throws to Larry Fitzgerald, soon to be Hall of Famer, for what was like a 65, 70-yard touchdown. And Fitz had one of the greatest playoff runs in the history of the NFL for a wide receiver during that. And it was like, oh, Fitz just caught the game-winning touchdown, and he's going to be the MVP of the Super Bowl. And Roethlisberger to Santonio Holmes, where Roethlisberger made plays coming down the field, and that one with whatever it was, 17 seconds or whatever it was left, and to know that they have to review this to make sure, and did he really get that down with three defenders in the area? It was it's something I'll never forget. I mean, fans will never forget it that watched it on TV, but to be blessed to be there on the sidelines and to see him go past me, like, I can't wait to bump in. I have not bumped into Santonio Holmes since then, but I will tell him, hey, dude, I was right there, and you remember when you did that? And he'll probably get a laugh out of it, but yeah, that's never nice. Never going to forget that.
Now, for me, a good anchor or broadcaster of any sports coverage is someone who shares that kind of passion that Scott has for the subject. It's someone who can combine that knowledge and passion with the ability to inform viewers and bring those around them into the conversation. But enough about describing me for a second. Does Scott agree?
Ooh. I would say a good anchor or even a good sports broadcaster or even a good broadcaster in general, you have to care about your audience more than you do about yourself or the way that you reflect to the audience. Here's what I mean. There's a subtle difference. And when I speak at universities to prospective broadcast journalists, I say this. When I was 21 years old, I wanted to be famous and rich and get to fly to the Super Bowl and all of these things. But that was about me, right? I wanted to be recognized when I walked into a restaurant and people would say, oh, there's Scott Hansen. I'll readily admit my ego was there when I was a young, up-and-coming sportscaster. When I matured and I learned, you know what? Why are you making it about yourself? Because every time I might flub a little bit of a word or maybe make a little bit of a factual error or something like that, I would get inside my own head and I would go, oh, and it would just snowball and compound. But why did I do that? Because I was thinking about myself. I was thinking about, well, how does Scott Hansen look in this matter? Now, when I focus on the audience and when I say, we are going to let it rip for 7 hours, all ad-libbed, with all kinds of facts and anecdotes and things that I will say out loud, I want the audience to have a great time. And I think about the audience during my preparation. I think about the audience during the morning of the show when I'm leading into it. And I think about the audience through all 7 hours of NFL Red Zone. And when you do that, when you want them to have a good time, you remove your own self, you remove your own ego. Of course, you're a part of it, but you're not as caught up in that. And I think it allows you to be a better servant to the audience. And that is what a good broadcaster is. You are there to disseminate information and to make it entertaining and palatable to all the people that are out there. And so that's the number one thing I would say in terms of a good broadcaster. Think about yourself less, think about the audience more.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. I think early on, I think broadcasters have to go through that. You worry about stuff. You know, you maybe say something and then you're looking on Twitter, what do people think? And I think as you grow and you get a thicker skin, I think you're right. You don't worry about so much when you trip over a word. I don't know if you remember when you were in the studio with me. I don't use auto cue. I don't like it because I feel I'm too stiff then. So I just ad lib everything, pretty much like we do on the NFL UK live stage shows. I feel like that's the way to bring it in, because here in the UK, the NFL comes on a Sunday evening at the end of the weekend. Everyone's putting their feet up. They've probably got a beer.
Yep.
And I don't think they care if I trip over a word or two, as long as I'm passionate and I enjoy the sport.
I 100% agree. And what you said right there leads me to another point about, you know, here in the U.S., and it's probably similar over there. Some people, most people work hard for a living, and they might get one day off, maybe 2 days off a week from whatever their 9-to-5 job is. And if they choose to spend that large chunk of time on a valuable day off Sunday with me, I'm going to give them everything I got, right? And some people will be critical, but that's just, you know, the nature of some people where if you, and I never try to make a factual mistake, but if I said, Aaron Rodgers threw 33 touchdowns last year and he actually threw 34 touchdowns, that's wrong. I don't want to make that mistake, but is that really going to end the world if I slipped up or I forgot one thing right there? And I'm not above, you know, criticism. I mean, like when people hit me up, if it's a factual error, I've got to own it and try and correct it when I can. But if I fumble a word, like people let it go. Everyone understands, dude, this is all coming right out of my head. And based upon what I'm seeing on my wall of monitors, you got to give me a little bit of slack there, I think, to be able to, you know, to do my job. And when you do make mistake, I found this, it does make you human, and people want to watch people that they can relate to. Right. You know, they would say, I want to go have a beer with that guy at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. They want to see you get the giggles. They want to see you enjoy it. Last one. Who are the players you love to watch? I mean, I don't know about you, but you talked about loving a team as a child. I didn't ask you which team. I don't think it really kind of matters now, but I don't know if you're a fan of the league. Like, I find myself, you know, people point to me, I was a Dolphins fan growing up. And people still say, oh, you're a Dolphins fan. But to be honest, I root for Fitz because I know Fitz and I went fishing with Fitz. But I'm a fan of the league. I love the whole thing. Are there certain players you love to watch every Sunday?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's probably low-hanging fruit to say Patrick Mahomes.
Definitely, yeah.
But Patrick, I would say this. Our last two MVPs, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson. They both are athletically brilliant. They both play the toughest position on the field. They both dominate in different ways, but have taken the skill set that they have and with combined it with the work ethic that they have been able to make us marvel on Sundays and Mondays and Thursdays and whenever they're playing. And they seem to be two of the most likable guys that are, I mean, there's a camera in their face all the time. And that's on the football field, in the post-game media session, when they're out to dinner with their family on a Tuesday night, there are cameras watching all the time. Neither one of these guys has made like a misstep or done something. And we're all human. We're all fallible. we're going to do or say something that's just dumb at some point. And both of these guys have represented themselves, their teams, their communities, and the NFL so well. They are so likable. And so I love watching them. I love watching Patrick Mahomes' arm stress a defense from sideline to sideline, from line of scrimmage to 60 yards downfield. He can stress a defense in that way. And I love watching Lamar Jackson's legs combined with his arm stress a defense sideline to sideline from the line of scrimmage, also 60 yards downfield, because even though he probably doesn't have as big of an arm as Patrick Mahomes, he can get guys more wide open because he'll attack the line of scrimmage, as we've all seen. Attack the line of scrimmage, DB's got to come up to make a play on the run, and boom, he goes over the top to Hollywood Brown or whatever. Those two guys, and I hope they both do it for another 10 years to come.
Yeah, they could be the new Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. They really could go back and forth. I think it's important just to finish in conclusion. This can be a short wrapping up, but you mentioned people work hard, and not everyone can do what we do. I think it's important to – I certainly try and remind people of this, that what we do is appreciated. I don't think we take it for granted, do we? When we turn up at the Super Bowl, we're not just going through the motions. I think it certainly is for me. I wonder if it's the same for you, that you genuinely appreciate every moment that you get covering the NFL.
You know what, Neil? It is, I do, but I would also say that sometimes I can fall into a trap. Anyone who does something, anyone who has made their passion their career, at some point, and it might be a fleeting moment, it might be one day, it might be 1 hour, it might be a bad 10-minute stretch, they'll be like, what the, ugh, you know, and they start complaining about it. And then I need to be disciplined in my mind to go back and think, 10-year-old Scott Hansen would whack you on the face if he heard you complaining because the camera's not working and you're on the sidelines of training camp and it's hot outside and you don't know if you're going to get the interview that you want from the player that you want to talk to, whatever, and you're just whining and complaining. Think about it. You're there. I will use one last little analogy. Before I became a studio host at NFL Media, I was a roving reporter. So I used to fly around to games and practices and go do stories, interviews, such like that. One day I had it was like a 6 a.m. flight, and meaning I had to wake up at 4 a.m. to get to the airport in time for this flight. And I'm sitting there and I'm tired and I'm yawning. And this was a little while ago, but you'll know the time period when I say this. And I was kind of complaining in my mind. Oh, I'm tired. Why are they making me go and do this one? Someone else could do this one. Da, 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 da. And I was sitting at the gate of the airport. And suddenly I just jolted myself and I looked around, and there's a bunch of guys and women in suits that are getting on the same plane. They're sitting around the gate waiting to get on the plane, and they're in suits. I said, Scott, those people right there are going to sit in boardrooms and look at line graphs and pie charts and budgets and whatever and be bored out of their mind. I'm getting on this plane to go interview Tony Romo after practice in Dallas. Shut your mouth and enjoy the moment. Enjoy the moments. Enjoy your career. That's what I said to myself. And I still have to remind myself every once in a while. NFL Sundays are not a problem, though. I promise you that. I promise you that. I am always legitimately and authentically keyed up for NFL Red Zone.
So there's my conversation with Scott Hansen. Hope you enjoyed that. Certainly enjoy spending time with Scott. Don't get to watch Scott, of course, as much as the rest of you, because I'm on another channel at the same time. But I know he is incredibly passionate, and I just we share an absolute love for this sport. So it was good to chat with Scott on that. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes for the mailbag. Gary, how are you, mate?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on again. Just quickly, what a great character Scott is.
Isn't he good? Isn't he good? It's like he's eating a load of sugar.
Yeah, and you talk about you talk about drinking the Kool-Aid, and I think, yeah, he's on something nice that gets him so bubbly and personable. And when we did that interview, he was in LA, and it was so early for him. but he's still like, maybe he'd had a few espressos or something, but he just came across as a, I've never met him, but he just seemed like someone that, he says there, when you talk about an anchor and what's a good anchor, and he says, yeah, I want people to be like, looking at me thinking, I want to go for a beer with that guy sometime. Right. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd want to go with Dan Hansus and Scott, those two together. And you, of course.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, come in third. That's all right. Made the podium. That'll do. I'll take that third place behind them two. Absolutely. What have we got in the mailbag, Gary?
So I was going to start singing Frank Sinatra, but I'm feeling a bit croaky because I thought we'd make it a New York special, if that's okay.
Ooh, go on then.
So, yeah, obviously we don't really do current news and current games on the podcast, but I thought as we're in the season that we could make this a little bit topical because we've had some questions come in about the Jets and the Giants, and obviously they're both enduring. Yeah, we should put that sound effect in, shouldn't we? they're both having a struggling season, shall we say, a tough season. So there's a question from Kevin O'Hare who says, now, if you can answer this question, I think you should be writing to the ownership and maybe getting the job. He says, Neil, what do the Giants need to do to compete?
Oh, my goodness. Score more than 9 points a game, which just seems to be the norm this season. That would help. I think it's just so they've reached such a low ebb that there is no kind of quick fix. And they keep trying to draft these. I mean, I don't think they draft particularly well. You know, there have been some really good offensive tackles so far in the NFL this season, rookies. One of them is not Andrew Thomas, who the Giants took with the first pick in their draft this year. So they need to be stronger on the offensive line. They need all kinds of help on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, I really think that's such an area of need. And I think this next year, the rest of this year and next year is about seeing what you've got with Daniel Jones. Is he the answer at quarterback? But, you know, I think he's got some decent weapons to throw to. I think Evan Ingram's a good tight end. I think Darius Slayton's an emerging receiver. Huge blow losing Saquon Barkley for the year at running back. You know, to see him affected by injury again is a real downer for the Giants. And it's hard because you haven't got the full strength team, so you can't evaluate your quarterback as well as you might. So it's a long way back. Let's put it that way for the Giants. I don't think there's one thing. I would say upgrade the offensive line, definitely upgrade the defense, and let's find out if Daniel Jones is for real. If not, we've got to move on again. But they did have a long, long spell of Eli Manning. So, you know, if they have to kick the tires on a few quarterbacks for a few years to find the next right one, then that's what they've got to do. But, yeah, it's New York football's terrible right now. I mean, New Jersey. They play in New Jersey. Everyone always corrects me when I say New York football. You know what I mean. They're the New York Jets. They're the New York Giants. But the only team that technically plays in the state of New York is the Buffalo Bills, and they're doing all right.
Yeah, Rutherford football. what I was going to ask as well, actually, because you talk about the quarterback there, and this isn't a question from the mailbags. It's a question from me, and I'm going to cross-reference our sister show, Game Pigs, because in our last episode of that with Charles Dagnall, you both started talking about Sam Darnold, and he scored that incredible, what was it, like a 40-yard touchdown where he looked like a running back. Mm-hmm. You know, quick feet, and you know, he looked really athletic, but there was a point in there that you made that I wanted to raise with you. You said you still feel like you can't judge him. You don't know whether he's going to, you know, make the cut or not in terms of his long-term future, whether he's good enough to lead the Jets.
Yeah, I think there's probably no quarterback in the NFL in as bad a situation as Sam Darnold for a number of reasons. I don't believe in his head coach, Adam Gase. He kind of developed this quarterback whisperer vibe, which basically came about because he happened to be in the right place at the right time in Denver when Peyton Manning was the quarterback. And trust me, Peyton Manning was telling Adam Gase what they were going to run, not Adam Gase telling Peyton Manning. It was that definitely Peyton was the top dog in that room. Sam Darnold has no weapons. He only just is beginning to see a semblance of an offensive line in front of him. You know, the Jets have been really poor this year, and the only player who's kind of shown up and often scrambling around trying to do something on his own is Sam Darnold. So I think as quarterbacks that came out at the same time as him have moved on and developed and progressed and become really exciting, you know, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, we haven't been able to see that with Sam Darnold. And this is only his, what we're in now, 20. So it's his third year. It's his third year and he's already at a career crossroads. And he can't really be at a crossroads this year because we're never going to be able to fully evaluate him. So I don't know what the Jets do with him. I don't know what they do I do know what they do with the coach, and they might have done it by the time you listen to this.
I was going
to
say, this disclaimer, this is being recorded before the Jets play the Cardinals.
This could be dating itself, but leave it all in. He could be gone by the time you're listening. They need to clean house. I would actually say start again, get everyone out on the coaching side, start to look to build some weapons. Don't let good players like Robbie Anderson leave as a receiver like they did this past off season, and see what you got in Sam Darnold, because I think there's something there. I think there's something there, and he's just in the most unfortunate situation in all of the NFL quarterbacks.
Okay, I think that answers my question. So
good, you're welcome, Gary. Please next time, send your question in writing with at least 3 days' notice so that I can.
I emailed it to myself just so I could say it's in the mailbag. Speaking of, you know, predicting the future and everything else, you've had a known broadcaster on this week, and I understand we've got another media personality. Can we call him a media personality?
Yes. He's an absolute giant of NFL writing. So he's Sam Farmer from the Los Angeles Times. And we talked about his life in football. And yes, it's not a current player and it's not a former player, but he's been around so many famous moments, so many big name players. You're going to get access like you've not heard before. I think Sam is, as you would expect, he's a journalist and he's a, you know, like I said, an amazing writer. He's a great storyteller. So make sure you tune in next time for Sam Farmer from the Los Angeles Times. That's everything for this week. My thanks to producer Gary Hayes and to Scott Hansen. But most of all, thank you for listening. As I said at the start, please spread the word, and we'll be back next week. Until then, bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.